So as we begin Malachim Aleph Per Gimel, on the very bottom of page 28, this is probably, in Per Gimel, one of the most famous stories of Shlomo. The baby story, yeah. That's going to be in this parak. And also this parak is also something which is read on as a Haftorah, as we'll see possibly today, later on in Parshas Miketz. But yeah, there's basically two parts of this story. One is, as we're going to, well, really three. The first about his marriages, plural. Second of all, when God gives him one request, he can have anything he wants. He requests wisdom. And then the baby story, which we'll see at the end, which is immediately afterwards, which shows his wisdom. That's the idea. Okay. So we begin with a difficult first sentence. Vayischanan avyischatein Shlomo es Paro melech Mitzrayim. So Shlomo wants to get married. So who does he marry? He has a chasna. So he probably had a wedding hall and a nice band. So who is the kala? Who is the kala? So his father-in-law was Paro, who was the king of Mitzrayim. So he married into the family of Paro Melech Mitzrayim. Very strange thing for a person to want to do. You would think that's not the smartest thing to do. First of all,
he was probably very smart. He was probably one of those. Well, but you said that long ago when we talked about the 1800 wives. His purpose was political.
Right. Exactly. We're gonna see that. Yeah, we're going to see that in shortly, that he did this with very strong motivations to try to retain his position of power. So being a king, he wanted to have allegiance with other kings and other countries, and the way that it's done, which was done by him, was done by many people following him, you marry the king's daughter, and therefore it establishes a greater bond between two different countries. And that's what he did.
Do that in terms of Yiddishkeit?
Oh, that's a problem. You would think that maybe it's a problem called marrying a non-Jew.
I learned that he did that in order to this guy to convert all these women. That's what I learned.
Yeah, so we'll have to see that in the commentaries. What was his halachic motivation? How was he rationalization? How was he allowed to do that? We'll see that soon. Let's just finish this pasuk. Vayikach as Bas Paro, so he took the daughter of Paro, Yevieha El Ir David, and he brought her to Ir David, the city of David, and the Radak says, what's Ir David? Ratza Lomar on page 30. El Sion, Shehi Shem Beis David, so there that's Beis David, Shem Beis David, but Sion Nikra Ir David. So the word Sion and Ir David were synonymous, same place. So he brought her there, ad kolosso livnos es beso, until he finished building up his house, ves beis Hashem, as well as the house of God, which is referring to the Beis HaMikdash, because Shlomo is going to be building the Beis HaMikdash. We're going to be seeing some upcoming prakim, upcoming chapters, exactly how he does that, the exact construction, how it takes place. Veschomas Yerushalayim Sodom, and also to build a wall around Yerushalayim as a form of protection. So, let's go back to page 28. First of all, Rashi tells us something quite fascinating over here. What is the connection? What's the juxtaposition between Shlomo's getting married to an Egyptian woman and the death of Shimi, which we just learned about in the end of the previous chapter? So Rashi says, and we'll see this also in the Radak a little bit more spelled out, quotes the following Gemara. The whole Zman, Shehoye Shimi, Rabo Kayim, as long as Shimi was alive, and the key word is Rabo, it was his Rebbe. Shimi was King Solomon's teacher, his Rebbe, someone that he looked up to, someone that he looked up to for guidance. Loi nischasin bo. He wouldn't think of marrying such a girl. He would, his Rebbe would shun him. He would say, "Well, what are you doing? It's not a shidduch. You know, it's not someone you should be marrying. It's beneath you."
Pasnish. This was his first wife. He had nobody before that. Is that clear?
It's not very clear, but it is also we're going to see it's pretty clear in a few sentences that he was also 12, maybe 12 years old, which is also another question. How did he marry someone?
He was a couple. But it was at least 3 years that Shimi was living in Yerushalayim.
Oh, so he maybe was already 15 or 16, right?
At least 15.
Right, that's true. Okay. That's a good point, because we're going to see in Pasuk Ches what exactly, whether in fact he was 12 at this time. Maybe he really should be older.
12.
He should be older, right, as you said.
It's at least 3 years.
Right.
At least.
Exactly, right. Mm-hmm. It has to be, because as we're saying, this is all
after
Shimi
died.
Right, so he's already been a king for a few years.
He had other Rabbeim, he had all these other learned people.
This was his teacher.
Yeah, but obviously he got another teacher.
You
always, what do we learn in, that we are supposed to always give yourself a good teacher.
Yeah. Right. So, but this was his teacher that he had for many years, and he looked up to, and he listened. Mekan Amru, from here we learn, Olam Yidar Adam B'Makam Rav. A person should always live nearby their Rebbe, near their teacher, so as to make sure that they give you the guidance and inspiration, because as soon as Shimi died, the Gemara teaches, Shlomo went, if I can use the word, astray, and married an Egyptian woman. Now, when people are learning this piece of Gemara, they're like, wow, you know, it was so nice that, you know, David had such a relationship with his Rebbe. Of course, what did David? What did Shlomo do to his Rebbe?
He knocked him off. So
he killed him. He killed him. Right. So. That's the advantage of being a good Rebbe, is your students may kill you anyway, quite literally, or figuratively. But that's what it means. In fact, the Gemara actually says that it says sometimes it's better not to live next to your teacher. The Talmud says it depends if you're someone that's willing to listen, if you're receptive to what they have to say. If you're not, if you're someone who wants to listen, it's better you should be by them, so they'll give you guidance, you'll accept it. If you're someone that doesn't always listen to your teacher, maybe it's better that you're not so close. It's better than being rebuked and then just doing it anyway, just ignoring the words of your rabbi. Anyway, that's what Rashi says.
I have another reason why I see the juxtaposition of these two topics.
Yeah.
The very last part of the parak was right after Shimi was killed, the kingdom was secure.
Right.
And to further secure the kingdom, he married these women.
Right.
I mean, it's
right.
All a matter of securing the kingdom.
Right.
I mean, that's
the yeah. That's absolutely. That's a very good point.
Securing the kingdom when you're in bed with all these other countries, so to speak, you're more secure. That's
right.
Exactly why they do it.
Yeah. That's absolutely that. That's 100%. Can't see where it's one of the English paragraphs that says it exactly what you said.
Oh, really?
I believe so. So, but let's now look in the Radak. The Radak says, as we began, v'yischatein Shlomo, darshu bo. So the Gemara says, this is why we connect Shimi's death to this next sentence. She calls Manche Shimi Kaim, as long as Shimi was alive. He would never marry such a girl. He was afraid of his Rebbe. Not so afraid, he killed him. But he was afraid of him. He listened to what he had to say. He used to rebuke him and teach him the proper ways to behave. So we see this is what, as you said, in the fourth year of his malchus, Nosa es bas paro, he married her. Shimi Yoshim Yerushalayim Shol Shanim, as it said before, that he was in Yerushalayim for 3 years, Shimi was, and then he went away and he was killed for not having listened to the king. Now the Radak asks a different question. How is he allowed to marry a non-Jew? Umasha kosov lo tischatein bom. It says, lo tischatein bom. You're not allowed to have chasnus. You're not allowed to marry someone who's not of this faith. Yesh merizal shomrim. So some say, ki begyusam nemar. That's referring to while begyusam, when they are still not Jewish. Begyusam is the word goy. Right. Well, in this gairu, right, she said, if they convert, mutar, there's nothing wrong with it. B'yesh omrim, and some say, ki begyusam lo hoyu lehem chasnos, v'lo shaykh mehem chasnos. Some say that they are not allowed to marry at all. V'chein kosel tischasim bom ki migeri havi. Because they are among the converts. I'll explain what this means in a second. If you read the next word, next sentence, the Shlomo Giar as Bas Paro. Shlomo did convert this girl. V'avar al loy tischatin bom. But he still violated this sentence. V'mi she'amr shol kibul gerim lo bimei David lo bimei Shlomo. Because in the days of David, in the days of Shlomo, they never accepted a single convert. They never allowed anyone to convert. If you look on page 30, which I underlined in the paragraph on the right, Solomon converted the Egyptian princess as well as the many foreign women he married subsequently, but he did so without the approval of the Sanhedrin. During the time of David and Solomon, and in other periods of Jewish ascendancy, the established courts did not accept converts because it could be assumed that they were not sincere. So everything is working out perfectly with the Jewish people, all of a sudden you want to join them so you're not killed, you'll be successful. So it wasn't a sincere conversion. So therefore, in the days of David and Shlomo, they were not supposed to accept any converts. That's the rule. Even though, of course, there is a concept of conversion, but they didn't allow it, at least for those generations. But Shlomo went against the Sanhedrin and converted them anyway. So therefore, it was a little bit of a violation of the sentence of lo tischasein bom, because he wasn't supposed to have converted them as he did.
It sounds so strange. I mean, it's hard to understand how you could do that, go against the Sanhedrin. Okay. It's got a certain formula that he's supposed to follow as a king. I mean, otherwise, why do you need the Sanhedrin at all? Are they going to be just the yes people like we have today?
Hello.
I mean, these places, I mean, this story here is so relative to what's going on today.
Go ahead, why?
Human nature. The king can do what he wants.
Yeah.
Well, in general, I mean, you know, validating, invalidating the base down in the way.
Right.
The murders are taking place today. It's so relative.
The Senate does what they want.
But this was his motivation, as Linda, you said, on page 29, which I did underline, this is what I underlined, and as you said before, the central theme of this chapter is that Solomon solidified his reign. He did this three ways. First of all, as we just said, by marrying the Egyptian princess, Solomon attempted to secure a peaceful relationship with his large and powerful southwestern neighbor. So that was his motivation for marrying her, so to make sure that the Malchus would remain strong. And then we're going to see the second, in a prophetic dialogue with Hashem, Solomon said that his primary wish, he granted the wisdom to govern the people properly. God promised him that and much more, which we'll see shortly. Then the young king's prowess was tested by the famous dispute between the two women, each claiming to be the mother of an infant, and Solomon's shrewd judgment, which we'll see what that was, earned him the respect and allegiance of the nation, because people saw that, in fact, he was wise. So this entire chapter is geared around his remaining in power and control. So, was it a good thing? Did God look upon this favorably, that he ended up marrying the daughter of Paro? Interesting, something was created in this relationship. And if you look in the English, which I underlined, which is a Gemara in Shabbos, says as follows on page 30. The sages teach, at the time that Solomon married Pharaoh's daughter, the angel Gabriel came down and inserted a stick into the sea. Maybe some of you have heard this. Mud began to gather around it, and it was on the land that was thus formed that the great city of Rome, whose army would one day destroying the temple in Jerusalem came to be built. So they say that Rome was not built in a day. Well, it was kind of built by Gabriel, by a stick, right? Meaning that Solomon's indiscretion planted the spiritual seeds of future catastrophe. Obviously, the sages considered the marriage to be improper. So Rome, which is responsible, goes Edom, destroying the second temple, the second base of Mikdash. Shlomo is the one that builds the first base of Mikdash. So he started it. Right, so his actions caused, ultimately, the destruction of the second base of Mikdash, which is very fascinating. But that's how it's brought down, that Rome was built because of this action. It wasn't a positive thing. But not necessarily the land, but the philosophy of being anti-spiritual feelings. Yeah.
But this is one more thing. When we talk about that he had all the wisdom. In fact, he didn't have all the wisdom. Because I'm learning from Hillis now, with somebody, and he said nobody ever got all the wisdom. Some was always kept back.
Right.
So when you think you can apply it here to Solomon, how could he do such a thing? Couldn't he think ahead of what might occur? Right. But he probably didn't have all the wisdom, and therefore he fell short of the mark.
Right. Isn't this before he had the wisdom? Before he
is that is true. That's true. We're going to see his wisdom was granted later on. Not yet. No. We're going to see right now. We're going to see he's going to have a dream, and he's going to wake up and have wisdom, which he didn't have.
He has Hashem.
Right.
But he married a lot of other women after, or he
right.
had the wisdom?
The problem sometimes is a lot of wisdom may also not be a good thing, because you can rationalize. Well, the Torah says you can't do it, and probably the Torah says you can't have too many wives for this reason. But I'm a different person. I'm an exception to the rule. So that sometimes it's better to be an eved, to be a servant. You just do exactly as you're told. These are my rules, these are the instructions. God tells me I cannot do this, I must do that. That's exactly what I'm going to do. I'm not going to start reading into things. So it could be precisely his wisdom that caused his downfall. Possibly. But this he did before he was given this extra dose of knowledge. So now let's continue. If you look in the Radak, I underline this stuff, so let's look at it. As base of as base Hashem. Now even though when he built these homes while the daughter of Paro was waiting, it sounds like he first built his house, then base Hashem, according to the order of the sentences. But the Radak tells us that's not the case. As base so achar base Hashem. He built his house after he built the base of Mikdash. Ki base Hashem bana mitchil b'shem Hashanim. It was built in the beginning of 7 years.
He's 19 years old.
That's when the base of Mikdash was.
But they said that it says here he brought this woman to the house, to these houses after they were built, right?
Right. In the meantime,
so
she was living in
here.
Right. In the meantime, she was living in Ir David. Or whatever.
Oh, so we're saying that he married her, and then 7 years later he brought her to these houses? Or
yeah, he kept her. It says in Pasuk Aleph on the top line that he married her, and she moved. She had to wait in Ir David until her house was being built.
Oh.
You know, and then afterwards she moved.
Oh, after he finished.
Then afterwards he.
It's interesting. Kala and Kaloto are the same shoresh.
That's right.
Like.
The
droid
is the end.
Why are you laughing? Okay. So if you look in the Radak says, "Es beiso achar beis Hashem." So again, he first built the base of Mikdash, then afterwards his house. Okay, and then it says, "V'achakach bana beiso b'shol shesrishana." Afterwards, he built his house in the 13th year. So we'll see that later on in the 7th chapter. Okay? Now let's move on to Pasuk Beis. Pasuk Beis tells us, "Rak ha'am mezavchim babamos." So there's no Beis Hamikdash yet. So when people wanted to bring an offering, they brought it on bamos, which were altars. Kilu nivna bayis l'shem Hashem ad hayamim ahem, because it was not built the Beis Hamikdash in those days. The Beis Hamikdash has not yet been built, and as Rashi points out, babamos u'mizbeach the genuso davar hakasa. The Torah is actually, the Sukkim are telling us something which is negative, a negative about Shlomo. Shisha es binyan habayis arbashanim. Why didn't he build it right away? Why did he have to wait for 4 years? So he waited for 4 years. He was the one that was going to be granted the the tzechus, the merit of building the Beis HaMikdash, why do they have to wait until his fourth year to build it? Okay, so that's why the Pesukim mentioned this. If we look further in the Radak, which I underlined, it says, Merzal Sh'amru. And this discusses another Indian, another discussion about marrying the daughter of Paro. He says, Ki mutaros haisalo. He was actually allowed to marry her. I'm on the fourth line, which is underlined. Ki mash amr banim asher yavod lehem dor ha-shlishi. The problem is, let's say she converted. So what's the problem? What, right? The Torah says you're supposed to love a convert. But when it comes to an Egyptian, there's an exception. You're not allowed to just marry an Egyptian woman or man who converts. The sentence says you have to wait ad dor shlishi, until the third generation, which means, so they convert, you have to wait until their child has a child. Then, so their grandchild can marry into Kahal Hashem. That's what the pasuk says. It says, "Asher yildam dor shlishi," only the third generation. That's what it said. That's straight from the Torah. So the question is, even if he converted her, it's still not acceptable, right? That's right. It's exactly the same concept as Moav. Banim v'lobanos. So Shlomo felt that that prohibition was only when it came to sons, right, and not to daughters. Which is, by the way, which is not, we don't hold like that. La halacha, there is no difference between banim and banos when it comes to a mitzri. It has to be the third generation. The distinction by a Moabite woman is, in fact, true, that you are allowed to marry a Moabite woman.
No matter.
Right away.
Even the first generation.
First generation right away. But Shlomo felt that that same concept also would apply to an Egyptian woman.
You see, if he had his Rebbe, he would have known this.
Perhaps. The FLP, or he didn't want to ask the question.
He didn't want to ask the Rebbe.
He waited until he died, so he didn't have to ask the question. The FLP, Shalom Nikva Halacha Kedivri Zeh, even though we did not establish that this is the law, as I said, FLP, Sha'omer Kikabol Haisa Biyado, he said that there was some tradition, this is how he interpreted it. Nir Devarav, this is how he understood that, in fact, he was allowed to do so. Kiwareinu Bikasov. We don't find anywhere in the sentences Shechata Shlomo al Shalakach Bas Paro. We don't find that he was punished. We don't find that he had committed a sin. So yeah, we saw in the English that it was improper, right? That Gabriel caused the Rome to be built, which ultimately caused the destruction of the Hamikdash. But we don't find actually in the sentences that Shlomo did anything wrong by marrying this Bas Paro. So because we don't find, if let's say we were the sages, you go through all the sentences, and you don't find that he was punished, so now what you have to do is you have to say, so what did he do that wasn't wrong? Why wasn't it wrong? So you have to rationalize how it was not a problem. Either, as you said, because he converted, and now you're saying probably because he was allowed to, according to this interpretation, marry an Egyptian woman, even the first generation. Because otherwise, we don't find he was punished. Ella, al-shehirba nashim. We do find that he was punished on being hirba nashim, having many wives, right? V'davak behem be'ahava. Al-shehesiras levavo. And he attaches himself with him until his heart turns, until they turn. V'niach nashav hanachariyos l'avod Elohim acherim. Ultimately, they end up being idol worshippers. So we find that flaw, but we don't find him just the act of marrying this Egyptian woman having been a mistake.
You say, where are you reading from?
It was the Radak.
Yeah. Oh, it's the Radak.
The Radak, yeah, page 30. So basically the Radak is just saying, as we said, that him marrying Bas Paro was not a sin.
Because it's not in the text.
We don't find anywhere in the text that he was punished.
Yet we give it all the credence in the world. So you can't have it both ways.
What do you
here
mean,
he's
always
saying it's not in the text, so maybe it wasn't a sin.
Right.
But so much that we learn is not in the text. It's in all the Mefarshim. And we take it as the face value.
Right.
We take it as practically everybody thinks it is text. So you can't have it both ways.
Even the things that are not text.
Okay, we know in the text. I'm going to keep going back to Uriah. Uriah is not in the text. We don't have anything in the text to say that Uriah did anything wrong. And yet, right. David is given a pass by some.
Or he did rebel. He didn't listen to the king. but he wasn't given certain instructions. But this is how the sages try to base their chazal. It doesn't come from thin air. It has to be based somewhat on the text. And then we don't find him being punished. And that was like a little bit of a sidebar, but the Radak for some reason mentions it in Pasuk Beis, really should have brought it in the previous sentence, Pasuk Aleph. So let's move on. Pasuk Gimel. V'yav Shlomo as Hashem. Shlomo loved God. He didn't just have Yiras Hashem. There's different levels. Fearing God. Loving Hashem is an even higher level. V'lechas b'chukos David Ovid. That he went and followed the same mitzvos as David did, his father. It was chukos. Even the laws which were statutes. These people don't necessarily make sense. He didn't care. He followed them, and he loved Hashem. Because a person who loves someone, when it comes to even a chok, even though you don't understand, if someone has some quirk, something that they like or they don't like, you don't question it. If you love that person, you do it for that person, because you know that that person care. You care about that person.
But it says, the chukos David Ovid. It's not the chukos of Hashem. It's the chuk of his father, whatever his father said.
So that's one interpretation. The way it's read, the English translation is based on the decrees of his father, which kind of means that David, on his deathbed, warned his son that you should adhere to the mitzvos. So he was steadfast in his mitzvah observance because of his father's command. That's another way of looking at it. Rabba Bamois, who Mizaveach Umachtir. When it came to bring sacrifices, he brought the sacrifices on a bama, and there the animals were consumed. They were burnt.
Where else was he going to bring it? Exactly. They only did it on bamos. There was no Beis HaMikdash.
It could have been on a maybe it was a private. There's maybe private bamos. Your own private little altar. Right. So it's very specific that he went to one place, and that's why Rashi says, "Bebamos mizavech begenu." Let's see one more pasuk. But yeah, we'll stop after that. V'yelach hamelach givona. So where was this place that Shlomo went? He used to go to Givon. Lizboach sham to bring sacrifices there. Kihi v'bama hagadolah. This was the great Bama, Elof Olos Yala Shloima Al Hamizbeachahu. And he would bring about 1,000 Olos, which are elevation offerings, which are completely consumed, which is no benefit except they're completely consumed on an altar. But Yomahu on that day, Rashi says, Biyom Echad. He brought them all in one day, or possibly all in a certain amount of time. But if you look in Rashi, on the previous page, on page 30, which is what I wanted to get to before, what is this Bama? This Bama Gedola? This is referring to the copper altar, which is discussed in the part which we're coming up to, Parshas Truma, the Tzava. Shiasa Moshe Bamidbar, in which Moshe fashioned while in the wilderness, which is the Mishkan. Bahukva Bashilo. And now Rashi gives us a little bit of a history lesson to bring us all the way back to Shmuel Aleph, that it was originally the Mishkan was in Shiloh with time with Eli, right? And Charva Shiloh b'mei Eli, because of the mistakes that happened over there. So Shiloh was destroyed. Uvola Nov, and it was brought to Nov, which we know was Nov Ir HaKohanim, which ultimately
they were all killed,
right? And then Charva Nov b'mei Shaul, and there's a Shaul, because Shaul's the one that gave the order to have them killed. Uvola Givon. And now the Mishkan is in Gibeon. So that was where the Mishkan traveled from place to place. And that's where he brought his sacrifices.
So there still was a Mishkan, but the people still were able to sacrifice on these Bamot.
Why do they call them Bamot? Why doesn't it just talk about Mizbeach?
Because I think there's a lot to talk about here. If you look quickly through the
English. They say Bamot are high places.
Right, so you have to ascend to bring the on an altar to bring it up.
That's where the word bima comes from.
To go up, and to make an aliyah, to get an aliyah, right. And just to conclude, on page 31, which is to wrap up this whole idea, which was said before, that which is underlined, it says, the Kli Yakar contends that Solomon surely did not sin intentionally. he must have erred in his interpretation of the halacha. Alternatively, he felt that he was required to do so, what he did in order to secure the safety of the nation by forging alliances with potential enemies, or because of the Kabbalistic reasons noted above, which you can read
on your own. Stop.